Before I begin tonight, I want to say a couple words of just the thanksgiving and give my appreciation for those who have served me and Tiffany this week, whether through food or having us over to your house or through just encouraging words that you have offered to us. This week has been exhausting, but it has been very blessed. I appreciate you all for constantly attending each service. You know, it seems like it's nowadays it's hard to get people to attend gospel meetings. And I think that's just a trend going around the entire country everywhere I've been. And I think if we could put our resurrection knowledge that we're learning this week to task, we can see that we should be having a excited feeling about reading the Bible, coming together as Christians and our Christian family, and in trying to encourage each other with all we have, and finding all those opportunities to do that. That's what resurrection is all about when it comes down to home. Another thing I want to say is that I sent an email to Jason with all the outlines that I have. So if you lose any of those, you will have them on Jason's email server. I also sent a whole bunch of other outlines that I did not get to preach that I wanted to talk about and I wanted to teach about. For example, I have about 3 lessons on what the Greeks believed about resurrection. Now, you've heard me reference what the Greeks believed about resurrection, but how do you know that's true? Well, you can look at that handout, and I go through all as much as the Greek literature that is relevant to the topic. The same thing with Judaism. I keep on constantly referring to what did early Jews or what did first century Jews believe about resurrection and the afterlife. I go through that in about 2 lessons in the handout that I sent to Jason as well. So if you are interested in that, talk to Jason. He can get you those outlines. And if you ever have any questions about anything I typed on there or whatever, you can always find me on Facebook, send me a question, and I'll give a snarky response. No, I'm joking. I'll try to help you as much as I can. Okay, so tonight we're in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Now, what we've seen so far in our study of the Apostle Paul's epistles is that he believes that God raised Jesus of Nazareth from the dead. Not that his body was left in the tomb, but there was no body left in the tomb. It was swallowed up in the victory of the resurrection. And we also have seen that when Paul talks about resurrection throughout his epistles, he is referring to bodily resurrection, not just some spiritual resurrection of going to heaven and that's it, but actually where we meet back with our bodies in some way. And he has used those 2 events, the Jesus resurrection in the past and our resurrection in the future, and he uses those 2 events to kind of describe what it means to live as a Christian, as a person who is in Christ in the present age. Now we're in 1 Corinthians 15. Paul has more to say about resurrection, more explicitly in this chapter than any other chapter. Now, some say in his description of chapter 15, verses 1 through 11, of Paul, when he's describing the gospel, the bare bones of the gospel story, that Jesus died and was buried and was resurrected on the 3rd day, and then he appeared to people. Paul is describing these events, some scholars have said, well, Paul was dead wrong here. For example, Rudolf Bultmann, who was one of the biggest 20th century New Testament scholars, Rudolf Bultmann claimed that Paul was dead wrong in this section, verses 1 through 11. He believed, and he says that, Bultmann believed that resurrection was just a way, when Christians use that term resurrection, that was just a way to see the death of Jesus a travesty as in the positive light. And so they began using resurrection to refer to Jesus as if he is still living and that began the Christian movement. That was Rudolf Bultmann's response, and that was his claim about what actually happened. Now, I like this quote by N.T. Wright, who is responding to Rudolf Bultmann's idea that, well, Paul was just wrong. He says, if Paul really allowed himself in so serious and sober an introduction to a carefully crafted chapter expressing the central point that underlay an entire letter, you know, we've seen what he says about resurrection, 1 Corinthians as a whole. To say something as drastically misleading as Bultmann imagined, he, Paul, is hardly a thinker worth wrestling with in the first place. If Paul is actually wrong about what he has to say in chapter 15, verses 1 through 11, about the historical event of the resurrection of Jesus, then Paul is not worth listening to. That is the point. And Rudolf Bultmann would say Paul is worth listening to because he's a great thinker. And he shows us the early Christianity and what was going on in there. And we can learn a whole bunch about Paul. But if he was wrong about such a great event, the core of Christianity, why in the world should we listen to him? Well, what did Paul believe? I think we'll see clearly here from this lesson and tied to all the other lessons I've preached so far is that Paul actually believed that Jesus' resurrection was a historical event of which there were loads of witnesses, and that event pointed forward to the actual historical event of resurrection for all of God's people. That is no doubt what he believed, and that's what he claims to believe. Now, one thing that's interesting is when some scholars try to say, well, the Christians, when they talk about the appearances and the witnesses that they had, that was just some kind of visions that they experienced, and those were just kind of like they were seeing ghosts of Jesus or something similar to that. What's funny about that is that the Corinthians had all types of spiritual gifts. We read about that in chapter 12 through 14. They had all types of spiritual gifts, but seeing visions of the resurrected Jesus was not one of them. And Paul did not even expect it to be one of them. The appearances that the early Christians see that he describes here is something completely other than just a spiritual experience. That's how Paul sees it. In verses 1 through 3, this is the introduction before he gets into the introduction. He says, now I would remind you, brothers, of the gospel I preached to you, which you received, in which you stand, and by which you are being saved, if you hold fast the word I preached to you, unless you believed in vain. And then he says in the first part of verse 3, for I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received. Now, a couple notes we can see from this section in verses 1 through the first part of verse 3. That Paul's main point right here, Paul's main point is that this, what he is about to say, has been the message since the inception of the gospel had been spreading. That is Paul's point. And it's almost as if he's saying, everyone knows this. We have all, meaning all the apostles, we have all been saying the same thing. And he goes on to say it when he says that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the scriptures. There are three elements right there that he notes that is just taken for granted to be the story that Christians of all types were telling right at the beginning, as early as Christianity goes. Jesus died, he was buried, and he was raised 3 days later. He says Christ died for our sins in verse 3. Without the resurrection, the cross is meaningless. Without the resurrection, Jesus' death is worthless. He will go on to explain in verses 17 and 56 that if there is no resurrection, you are still in your sins. Why? Because the only way you can be forgiven of sin, the only way forgiveness of sins can come into the world is if Jesus was resurrected. Take that away, and it takes the whole paradigm, the whole structure of Christianity, and collapses it. Full forgiveness of sins is what happens at full return from exile. This is what the prophets were saying in Jeremiah 31, verses 31 through 34, Ezekiel 36, 22 through 32, and Daniel 9. They all connect return from exile as the moment that God will finally forgive Israel of all their sins completely, one and forever, in a way that He had never forgiven them before. And now Christ, He is the event. His death is the event where return from exile is happening. He died for our sins. And He says, according to the Scriptures. And I don't think when He uses this phrase, according to the Scriptures, I don't think He's using that meaning I can point you to a couple of proof texts to make a point. I think what He's saying is this is the entire story. The entire story of the Old Testament has been pointing in this direction and showing this. Death and resurrection. That is the pattern of how God does things, in other words. And we could look at all types of proof texts that would kind of show that idea. But the story that the Old Testament is telling reaches its climax in the story of Jesus' death and resurrection. And He says in verse 4 that He was buried. Now, it's interesting to note that He mentions the burial right here in this quick way of describing these events, the core central events of the gospel message. Why does He mention the burial at all? Well, I think there's two reasons He probably does. Number one, it certifies that Jesus was actually dead. You don't bury someone unless they're actually dead, and you know they're dead. And number two, he is setting that up, using the mention of the burial to set up that this resurrection was bodily, leaving an empty tomb behind it. The empty tomb was the first thing that caused the disciples to be puzzled and made them start asking questions, you know. And it says in verse 4, He was raised on the third day. Now, Hosea 6, verse 2, it has the reference to on the third, after 3 days, I will raise Him up. But there in the original context, talking about Israel, He's going to raise Israel up. But Jesus becomes Israel incarnate, being actually raised from the dead. And apparently this passage, Hosea 6 and verse 2, was being read by the first century in very much this way. Many rabbis even talk about how resurrection is connected to 3 days, and rabbis who were not Jews. But the fact there is a time lag, the fact that there is a time lag between the death and the resurrection underlined what resurrection meant for Paul. It meant not just a way of going to heaven, or not just a way of talking about a post-mortem existence. It meant a coming back to life, of which when he was dead was not true. And the point that Paul is making in verses 3 through 4 is that, the point that I want to make is that Paul could, by the early 50s, make these succinct truth statements and truth claims as if all Christians knew them well. You know, some scholars even think that this, 1 Corinthians chapter 15, the first part, verses 1 through 11, or somewhere around that area, is an early creed. And a creed is a succinct statement to kind of like to memorize and make it easy to express what you believe. That sounds a lot like what's happening here when he says that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures, and that he appeared. Just a quick, succinct summary of the story of the gospel. In verses 5 through 7, it's not enough just to say he died and was resurrected. You have to have witnesses. And Paul calls the witnesses to the stand in verses 5 through 7. And first of all, I want you to see here that the list of witnesses that he uses shows that Paul clearly sees this event, Jesus' resurrection, as a historical event. It is not just a subjective Christian experience. One scholar said the great variety in times and places of the appearances make it difficult to hold all the reports of appearance to be legendary. But first we see Cephas. He mentions the first one that is mentioned to be for Jesus' body and Jesus' risen self to appear is to Cephas. To Cephas. Now that is recorded in Luke chapter 24, verse 34. Paul calls Cephas, he calls Peter Cephas elsewhere. And it seems like when Paul talks about Peter, he calls him Cephas. Luke calls him Simon in Luke chapter 24, verse 34. He probably was not really called Peter until much later in his life. But here, Peter is described as seeing Jesus, the risen Jesus. And then he moves on to the 12, then to the 12 at the end of verse 5. The question here is, what about Judas Iscariot? Because Judas was dead by the time Jesus rose from the dead, right? Well, so is he clumping Judas Iscariot in there? And there's all types of explanation what's going on here. I think probably what it's referring to is Matthias being part of the 12, the new 12, in Acts chapter 1, verses 12 through 26. But what we have right there is already we have at least 12 witnesses that Paul is bolstering up. Then he goes immediately in verse 6 to more than 500 saw him at one time. More than 500, it says, then he appeared to more than 500 brothers at one time. Most of whom are still alive, though some have fallen asleep. Now, the one question is, when did this happen? Because the Gospels don't really give the story of when this happened. The closest example, I think, is Matthew 8, 28, verses 16 through 20. But wherever it happened, it's not explicitly recorded. But Paul here mentions it as if it's already well-known and a well-known event. Why does Paul mention this? The answer is found in the next phrase. Most of whom are still alive. In other words, Paul is saying, if you have any questions about these witnesses and what their testimony is, you Corinthians can go interview them. All of them, if you want to. Paul is inviting any skeptics of the time to interview the witnesses. And then he mentioned James in verse 7. Then he appeared to James. No scholars question that this is James, the brother of Jesus, that's being described. Now there's four Jameses mentioned in the New Testament, but no one questions this is talking about James, the brother of Jesus. And again, this event is not told in the Gospels, but it is common knowledge by the time Paul is writing this. If James was not known to have witnessed the resurrected Jesus, it would be extremely difficult to explain how he would have become in such a prominent position as one of the leading men of the Jerusalem church, let alone why he would convert in the first place. Then he goes on to, then to all the apostles in verse 7, or at the end of verse 7. Now that doesn't seem to be a reference to the 12 apostles. He already mentioned that at the end of verse 5. What it seems to be is that it is either a larger group than the 500 that he already mentioned, or at least a larger group than the original 12. If you look up the word apostle in just a regular accordance, you will see that there are several more people called apostles than just the 12. And it's rather enlightening. Now that doesn't mean they were known as the apostles, but they were certainly sent out in some way. That's what they're word apostle means, to be sent out and to proclaim a message. But notice what's missing in all these witnesses. The women's testimony from the Gospels. They were the first ones to see Jesus. Why does Paul not mention him there? Well, I have no idea. But I just threw that out there just to show that there's even more witnesses that Paul doesn't even mention. But anyway, in verses 8 through 11, now Paul turns to his own experience. Paul himself sees Jesus. And he says, this is the last witness of the resurrected Jesus. So in verse 8, he says, last of all, as to one internally born, he appeared also to me. The last of all, seeming to be a chronology, he's giving a chronological account about this. Once Paul saw the risen Jesus, it was to be expected no more sights of Jesus would be given to anyone. He's the last one. One writer said, had this not been known to be the case throughout the early church, Paul could scarcely have made this claim when writing to the Corinthians, who, in addition to their own rich variety of Christian experience, had had several teachers who were independent of Paul. Paul assumes this is a claim that would not be challenged by the Corinthians like his own apostleship was, like we saw in 2 Corinthians, where the Corinthians are challenging Paul's apostleship. They don't challenge the resurrection. They know that's dead fact, historical fact. Paul's witness, he describes it as very peculiar to all the other witnesses. He describes it as him being one who was born at the wrong time, or born untimely. He says that in verse 8 where it says, last of all, as to one untimely born, he appeared also to me. What does this phrase mean? Now what's interesting is that this phrase, to be untimely born, was usually used for a miscarriage or an abortion. A premature birth that was either killed by being stillborn or being aborted. Now Paul is kind of using that abortion stillborn imagery to refer to himself. What does that mean? What's going on here? Well, what I think it means, and you can read some of this, I'm going to skip some of this, what it says, but I think the idea is that Paul is the one guy who completely changed his worldview overnight. All the other apostles and all the other witnesses, they had been following Jesus up to the point of his death and resurrection. They did not have to start from, A, B, C. They were already down the road in maturing their understanding of Christ and what he was all about. He had been preparing them for that. Paul? He wasn't. It was as if Paul, by seeing the vision of Jesus, the resurrected Jesus, appeared to him on the road to Damascus, it is as if he is being stripped and ripped from the very womb of zealous Judaism. Extremely fast, extremely early. And he notes how undeserving he is of being a witness in verses 9 and 10. He says, for I am the least of the apostles, unworthy to be called an apostle, because I persecuted the church of God. And he says, but by the grace of God I am what I am, and his grace toward me was not in vain. On the contrary, I worked harder than any of them, though it was not I, but the grace of God that's within me. This grace that he's referring to, that he received, is not necessarily referring just to his salvation. It is also referring to the fact that God chose to make him an apostle. And Paul's attitude is, I did not even deserve that. But Paul's point in verse 11, he says, whether then it was I or they, so we preach. And so y'all believed, or all y'all believe. That's the plural there. But anyways, what he's saying here is that we all, Cephas, James, Paul, all the 500 witnesses, all the apostles, all the 12 that he mentions, we have been saying the same exact thing. There has not been any changes. The story has not evolved. We have been saying the same exact thing. Jesus rose from the dead, bodily resurrection. If Paul and the others had intended to refer to anything other than this, Jesus' bodily resurrection, the talk of scenes would be irrelevant. The idea that they occurred for a while and then no more would be incomprehensible. And the idea that with this event, the new age had broken into the present age would be unimaginable. The only ingredient that makes Christianity make any sense whatsoever is if they believed in a bodily resurrection of Jesus. In verses 12 through 28, Paul is making the argument now. Now he's addressing the argument front face here. And he says, now, if Christ is proclaimed as raised from the dead, how can some of you say that there's no resurrection of the dead? There in verse 12. That's the problem he's dealing with. Some of the Corinthians are claiming there is no such thing as resurrection from the dead. Now, what were these guys, what did they believe? Now, it doesn't say anything about whether or not they believed in an afterlife. They probably did. If they came from Stoic philosophy and Greek philosophies, the popular belief at the time was that you believe in an afterlife, you just don't believe in resurrection. Resurrection's not it doesn't go in line with Stoicism and Platonism and all those philosophies. It doesn't seem like they're necessarily denying the reality of life after death. But they're denying that the hope is resurrection. And there's a key difference there. They are denying, and even more, they are denying the future resurrection, not the past resurrection of Jesus. And that's what Paul is building off of there in verse 12. He says, now if Christ is proclaimed as raised from the dead, how can some of you say that there is no resurrection of the dead? He assumes they believe Jesus was resurrected from the dead. In verses 13 through 15, Paul claims that denying the future resurrection implies denying Jesus' resurrection. And he is saying you cannot believe in Jesus' past resurrection if you do not believe in a future resurrection. They go hand in hand. You cannot have one without the other, is what Paul is saying. And if you deny the future resurrection, the logical implication is you have to deny the past resurrection of Jesus. And Paul would have none of it. This falsifies the gospel itself. And in this entire section, verses 12 through 19, Paul uses several reductio ad absurdum arguments. Arguments that try to take a position to its logical extreme conclusion and show how ridiculous it is. And he uses those arguments to show how the logic follows if the future resurrection is denied. And in verses 20 through 28, Paul shows how Christ's resurrection and everyone else's is connected. It's tied together. They cannot be separated. You deny one, you have to deny the other. What Paul's point is. When he's using the term resurrection throughout this section, it's clear that they are denying what Paul is affirming is bodily resurrection. They are denying bodily resurrection, something that is distinguished from non-bodily survival. And Paul's the main point that he's getting at in this section is that denying the future resurrection produces all types of extreme inconsistencies in the entire Christian worldview and Christian identity. So in verses 12 through 19, Paul basically says, if there's no future resurrection, I don't care if you believe in an afterlife or not, if you deny future resurrection, there is no afterlife at all. There is no hope at all. And we could look at some of this in more detail, but I want to jump to verses 20 through 28. In verses 20 through 28, in this section, Christ's resurrection is the anticipation of our resurrection. Christ's resurrection himself becomes kind of the foreshadowing and the down payment of our resurrection in the future. And that's Paul's argument, verses 20 through 28. Paul is wanting the Corinthians to think in terms of the future and of the future resurrection, that Jesus' resurrection itself begins this new age that is coming from the future into the present when the Christian comes into Christ through baptism. And Paul is arguing for the certainty of the future bodily resurrection of Christ's people. Here we see the main framework that makes resurrection make sense. Paul is building the reasons why a resurrection makes sense in the entire Christian worldview. So we can see I have about 10 different notes, 10 different features here that I think are important in Paul's section here in verses 20 through 28. First, Paul describes Jesus' resurrection as the first fruits. So in verse 20 he says, but in fact Christ has been raised from the dead, and he calls Christ's resurrection the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. What was the idea of the first fruits? The idea of the first fruits to the Jews was that first fruits conveyed the idea of a guarantee of more to come, a guarantee of more in the future. So for example, when he would say that, he told the Jewish people in the law of Moses that you have to give the first year crops to the tabernacle, donate them to the tabernacle. And the idea there was, you are giving your first crops to, and you are sacrificing to them to the tabernacle in hopes of that God will provide for you in the future. And that's the concept of first fruits. Now, Jesus' resurrection is described as, in that term, first, the first fruit of what will happen to us. Secondly, I want you to see here is that the reason Jesus' resurrection is the first fruits, why? Why is it the first fruit? Because of his status as the true human, the one true human that ever lived. In verses 21 through 22, look what he says here in verses 21 through 22. He says, for as by a man came death, by a man has come also the resurrection of the dead. And he says, for as in Adam all die, so also in Christ shall all be made alive. He's contrasting the first man with the last man, so to speak. And he's going to call him the last man in a minute, and we'll see what that phrase means in more detail. But the idea here is that Jesus himself fulfilled all that Adam was supposed to be. Jesus fulfilled what a true humanity looks like as God designed. And he quotes Psalm 8. He quotes Psalm 8 here in verse 27. Look at verse 27 where he says, for God has put all things in subjection under his feet. He's quoting Psalm 8 and verse 6 there. And he's going to go on to explain, but when it says all things were put into subjection, it's plain that he's accepted who put all things in subjection under him. For God has put all things in subjection under his feet. Now, this psalm, he quotes Psalm 8. Psalm 8 verse 6. That Psalm 8, celebrates humanity as the centerpiece or the vice regents of God's creation. Now he's quoting that passage, Psalm 8, and now applying it straight to Jesus. Jesus becomes the ultimate human that shows what it means to have dominion over all the world and what it means to be human. Paul's not just using some proof text here, I don't think. I think this is the narrative of which Jesus becomes the climax. Just like Israel failed to be God's people, and thus God sent Christ to be the fulfillment of Israel. Adam failed to be human, and God sends Christ to be the true successful human. In verse 28, the purpose of this whole story is that God may be all in all. Look at verse 28 where he says, when all things are subjected to him, then the Son himself will also be subjected to him who put all things in subjection under him, that God may be all in all. I take that to mean that God will truly be seen as fully God by all creation when that takes place. Resurrection is the key ingredient to make all of this happen. Paul can only be talking about bodily resurrection, otherwise none of his explanations would make any sense whatsoever. In verse 23 and verses 27 through 28, the heart of his argument is about the order of this new creation narrative. So look at verse 23. Verse 23, he says, "But each in his own order, Christ the first fruits, then at his coming, those who belong to Christ." Now, he's using that word order here. In verses 27 and 28, he uses, which my translation says, subjection. So he said, "For God hath put all things in subjection under his feet." But when it says all things are put in subjection, it is plain that he has accepted who put all things in subjection under him. And it goes on to use that subjection word again. These are the same exact words. When it says in verse 23 that he says, "But each in his own order," that word order is the same exact word that's translated subjection in verses 27 through 28. Now, the first time that's used in verse 23, when it says each in his own order, he's referring to the chronological timing of Christ's resurrection in compared to our resurrection in the future. So he says, "But each in his own order, Christ the first fruits, then at his coming, those who belong to Christ." In verses 27 and 28, when he uses that term, he's referring to hierarchy. Christ, God is over Christ. And in Psalm 8, creation in general is what is entrusted to mankind. But here, it is new creation. Paul interweaves kingship language from Psalm 110 and Daniel to show that the entire created order is to be brought under full subjection to God. A perfect world where God is fully king. Verse 26, "For this world to be, and for God to be fully king, and to be fully all in all, death itself must be defeated." So in verse 26, he says, "The last enemy to be destroyed is death." The last enemy to be destroyed is death. Death is a problem, Paul is saying. Death is a problem that only resurrection can fix. Resurrection is then a reversal of death. It's not a redefinition of death. It's not a manipulation of death. It is not a compromise with death. It is a complete destruction and reversal of death. This further demonstrates Paul has bodily resurrection in mind. Next, Paul echoes several Old Testament texts. So he's going to echo Daniel chapter 2, verse 44. In verse 24, where he says, "Then comes the end, when he delivers the kingdom to God the Father after destroying every rule and every authority and every power." Well, Daniel 2, 44, you have there the picture of the statue and representing the powers of the world, and then the big boulder out of nowhere comes in and destroys those kingdoms, and it lasts forever. Here you have the same type of picture going on here. The kingdom, God's kingdom, destroying every single rule, every single power, God becoming fully king. In Daniel chapter 7, verse 14 and verse 27, you have the picture of the one like the Son of Man, who goes up on the clouds to the Ancient of Days, and he is reigning with God. God is sharing the dominion and the kingdom with him. In verse 27 of Daniel chapter 7, we see that even the saints, God's people, share in the kingdom with that Son of Man. Here, he's using those type of language here. Verses 24, verse 25, and verse 25 at the end, he says, "until he has put all his enemies under his feet that comes straight from Psalm 110, verse 1, where it is describing Jesus as the true priest king of Israel. Psalm 8 shows that God had made man to be a type of intermediary between creation and the Creator. Now Jesus is becoming that intermediary between the creation and the Creator, the job that humanity failed at. So we can see that Paul is telling a story in trying to explain the resurrection. Paul is telling a story. The story goes, the Messiah fulfills the role of humanity to be the one who brings order to God's creation. He destroys all powers, including death, and those in the Messiah are bound up with him to rule the world. And this all leads to God being seen by all as truly God. And in verse 26, the future defeat of death is the part of the story that Paul is focusing on. So you see that in verse 26, the last enemy to be destroyed is death. That's what Paul is focusing on in this section. Christ's people will be resurrected right before the end, as he says in verses 23 and 24. And Paul, notice that Paul takes it for granted that this resurrection has not happened yet. When Paul's writing this, wherever those are who are presently dead in the Messiah, in Christ, at the moment, they are still waiting to be raised. The point is that resurrection is the key factor. It is the key factor in the Messiah's job of destroying death once and for all. Paul describes Christ's coming. His parousia is when this resurrection takes place. That's the same language that he uses in 1 Thessalonians 4, verses 14 through 17, Philippians 3, verses 20 through 21. The resurrection of Jesus is the origin and the means by which the Creator will raise all the Messiah's people to new bodily life. The origin and the means. This all has great political overtones as well. The Messiah has a kingdom, not Caesar, which is going to destroy all other authorities, including Caesar's. The present order of things is this. Caesar's at the top, his agents are in the middle, and then all others are at the bottom, being exploited and being whatever. But the future order of things is God is at the top, the Messiah and the Messiah's people are in the middle, and the rest of creation is at the bottom, not to be exploited, but to be rescued. That is the picture that Paul is painting of the further background of resurrection. Then we come to verses 29 through 34. In verses 29 through 34, Paul gets practical. And Paul just blurts in with a couple of verses, about five verses, and he's just saying, if there is no future resurrection, everything we're presently doing is absolutely meaningless. And I'm not going to spend that much time on this, but you can see in verse 29, he makes a reference to the baptism. Those who are being baptized for the dead, that's pointless. You think about, the scholars debate what that's talking about, but you just think about what did baptize symbolize to begin with? Baptize symbolized death and resurrection. And your body is being put in the water and taken out. What's the point of that symbolism if it's not pointing to something real that has something to do with that symbolism? It's meaningless. In verses 30 through 32, suffering for the gospel is meaningless. In verses 32 through 33, Christian morality is meaningless. So he says here in verse 32, what do I gain if, humanly speaking, I fought with beasts at Ephesus? If the dead are not raised, he says, let's eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. And he's quoting Isaiah 22, verse 13 there. And he says, do not be deceived. Bad company ruins good morals. So he quotes one from Isaiah 22, 13, a passage which is describing what people live like when they're not taking the future into consideration. They just live it up. And then he quotes a Greek poet, a Greek playwright, in verse 33, where he says, do not be deceived, bad company ruins good morals. And usually when Paul says, don't be deceived, it's because it's easy to be deceived about this thing. He says, bad company ruins good morals. Well, that comes straight from the poet named Menander, who was an Epicurean poet. And in his play called Thyse, he wrote this. And the point of the play in this, in the part where he quotes, is that one guy is scolding another guy in the play because he's trying to show that living around people who are careless about the future leads to your own good habits being eaten away. Paul's saying, even Greeks know that. The resurrection is the foundation for Christian moral ethics again. And then the fourth thing we see here is he just says, wake up. In verse 34, wake up from your drunken stupor, as is right. Do not go on sinning, for some have no knowledge of God. I say this to your shame. When he says that some have no knowledge of God, what is he talking about in the context here? He's talking about resurrection. They don't understand that God is a resurrecting God, and that leads to all types of problems. And he's saying you should be ashamed because of the ignorance in your church about this. Paul is saying, get your thinking right. Get your thinking right. Otherwise, it's just like you're in a drunken stupor. Recognize who the true God is, and everything will become clear. We move on to verses 35 through 49. Now, did I warn that this is going to be a long sermon? In verses 35 through 49, Paul is answering the question. So he's built his logic and argument up why we should expect a future resurrection. He bases that resurrection on the past resurrection of Jesus. And he uses like Psalm 8, Psalm 110, and Daniel 7 to bolster up that argument and to show the bigger picture of how resurrection fits in that. But now he's addressing the question, what kind of body will it be? So you can imagine someone say, okay, Paul, you keep on talking about this resurrection, bodily resurrection. Okay, if that's true, I got one for you. What kind of body is it? And it's kind of like they think they got it, you know. Well, let's see how Paul answers that question. So he asks that question, he says, but someone will ask, how are the dead raised, and with what kind of body do they come? This section is built on Genesis chapters 1 and 2, and you can see the theme of new creation already coming to the forefront. You see all of these echoes from Genesis chapter 1. I mean, God created the heavens and the earth. Well, Paul uses those two categories in verse 40 to talk about his argument. God made the lights in heavens. God mentions those in verse 41. God made plants and seed in the plants. Paul uses those seed and plants as just a metaphor, an analogy that he's using to explain his argument here in verses 36 through 38 and verses 42 through 44. God made every kind of bird, animal, and fish. He mentions those in verses 39 through 40. God's spirit animated Adam and Eve. He breathed life into them. He breathed his spirit into them. Well, Paul talks about a spirit that is going to be breathed into us at the resurrection, verses 44 through 46. And God made man in his image, the climax of creation. Well, God is going to again make man in a new image, in the image of the Son, the true human, in verses 47 through 49. The point of seeing all that is that this is a new Genesis story. This is a new Genesis story, and resurrection is part of the bigger picture of new creation. Paul's argument begins with discontinuity and continuity, or discontinuity within continuity. For example, in verses 36 through 38, he's using the analogy of a seed and the plant coming from the seed. Now, obviously, the plant is not the same thing as the seed, but one comes from the other. You don't have a plant unless it comes from that particular seed. You don't plant the seed here, and then the plant pops up over there. It's not how it works. They're connected. The old is connected with the new, but the new swallows up the old. In verses 39 through 41, each species has a different body built for that particular environment. And Paul is saying in verse 42, this is how the new body will be. There's going to be similarities with the old body, but there's going to be drastic differences with the old body as well. And I want to move on to verses 35 through 41. He says, but someone will ask, how are the dead raised? With what kind of body do they come? And he says in verse 36, you foolish person, what you sow does not come to life unless it dies. And what you sow is not the body that is to be, but a bare kernel, perhaps of wheat or of some other grain. So he's using this analogy of a plant and a seed. Okay, let's think about how to bury a seed. You bury a seed, and then it pops up, you know, after a while, after it's been fed and all that, kind of watered and all that. But it's not exactly the same thing, even though it came from that seed. The seed goes away. It's not as if the plant comes up and then the seed still remains in there. The seed gets swallowed up in the plant in some way. Paul's saying that's kind of how resurrection works. Verse 38, he says, but God gives it a body, talking about the plant, the actual plant. He's using that terminology as the body. He gives it a body as he has chosen, and to each kind of seed its own body. He goes on to say, verse 39, for not all flesh is the same, but there is one kind of humans, another for animals, another for birds, and another for fish. There are heavenly bodies and earthly bodies. So in verse 39, now he moves the analogy to just all animal life. And he's saying, even in the animal kingdom, you can see differences in the different species with their bodies. For example, a fish has a body that is appropriate to live where fishes live. That's water. If you got a human body and made it try to live like a fish, you know, with no technology, you'd die pretty fast. It's not appropriate for that type of environment. Same thing with birds. Birds, their appropriate environment is to be able to fly in the sky. You try to make a human do that, and it doesn't work very well. And that's the picture here. God has made these particular bodies for these particular environments, and they work because that's how God made them. So he says in verse 40, there are heavenly bodies. So now he moves on from the plants and the seed analogy to all animal kingdom animals and their bodies and how they work with their environments. And now he's going to move on beyond this world and into the heavens or the universe and says, let's talk about the planets and stars and moon and all that. And he says, there are heavenly bodies and earthly bodies, but the glory of the heavenly is of one kind and the glory of the earthly is of another. There is one glory of the sun, another glory of the moon, and another glory of the stars. For star differs from star in glory. Now again, he's using that same phrase, body, to refer to these planets and all of that. And he says God made each one of them different for different purposes. And if we understand that, we can understand how God will make a new body for us to live in the appropriate environment of that new world in the presence of God. In verses 42 through 49, Paul is saying, so it is with the resurrection of the dead. What is sown is perishable. What is raised is imperishable. It is sown in dishonor. It is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness. It is raised in power. It is sown in natural body. It is raised a spiritual body. He says, if there's a natural body, there's also a spiritual body. Now I want you to notice here in verses 42 through 43, he is applying those analogies he used and say, that's what it's like. That's what the resurrection is going to be like. Something like that. Your body is sown into the dirt or whatever, and it's perishable, it's decaying, it's corruptible, but when it raises, it is no longer decayable, if that's a word. It's no longer incorruptible. It is completely immortal. Why? Because God gave it a new body. Just like in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, Paul says we will be further clothed. We will put on a new heavenly dwelling on top of our earthly dwelling. How exactly that all works scientifically, we have no clue. But that's the picture Paul paints. And when he describes this spiritual body, he describes the future body as a spiritual body. He says it's sown a natural body, it's raised a spiritual body. And he says if there's a natural body, there's also a spiritual body. Now one thing, that this has kind of caused confusion to many scholars, because what they take there is that natural body refers to a physical body, and spiritual body refers to a non-physical body. But that's not necessarily how Paul is using those words. And here's why. First of all, if you just look at how ancient philosophers thought about physicality, they did not think in terms of material and immaterial. They believed everything was material. It's just that the things you can't see and the things we would call soul and spirit and all that, it's made of finer substance. That's what ancient philosophers would have believed. Now, also, this is not how Jews thought in the terms of material versus immaterial. They thought in terms of that what you look at the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the Septuagint, it uses the word for soul, psuche, for the whole person, not just the unseen part, and for life in general that energizes all living things. And this is not how early Christians thought. They did not think in terms of material versus immaterial. But most importantly, we can look at, this is not how Paul thought in terms of material versus immaterial. So we look at this word that's translated natural in verse 44, where it says, it's sown a natural body. That's what my ESV said. It translates that term. Now, what's interesting about that term, it's the same exact term that was used in chapter 2 when Paul was comparing the two types of people. You have the spiritual people, and then you have the soulish people. The term comes from the word soul, the same word that Plato used to describe the thing that would leave your body and live forever in the island of the blessed. But what's interesting here is Paul is saying this type of soul body, it's the thing that's going to die. It's the thing that is we're living in right now. And we're going to be raised a spiritual body. Well, let's look at how Paul uses that term for spiritual. In chapter 2, verses 14 through 15, Paul used these two categories for types of people. You have the spiritual people, you have the spiritual people versus the soulish person, the soul person. In chapter 3, verse 1, spiritual there is not necessarily referring to physicality, but rather morality. You live in consistency with the Spirit of God. In chapter 12 and verse 1, again, these spiritual gifts, it's the same word, spiritual. It's not about whether the gifts were physical or not. It's about whether they were from the God, from God's spirit or not. That's where you get the word spiritual from. It's from God's spirit giving you that gift. It's a spiritual gift. In chapter 10, verses 3 through 4 is a clear example where the Israelites are described as eating in the wilderness spiritual food and spiritual drink. Paul's not making the point that they were out there eating invisible food and drink. They were actually eating physical food and drink, but it came from what? It came from God's Spirit. And thus it was called spiritual food and spiritual drink. Chapter 14, verse 37, Paul used that term spiritual again when he's saying some people suppose themselves as spiritual. He was not referring to people who believe that they're not physical. And here in chapter 15, verses 44 through 46, you have the soul people, the soul body, contrasted with the spiritual body. I like this quote right here. It says, had Paul wanted to produce the kind of contrast suggested to a modern reader by physical and spiritual, not only would pneumatikos, the word that's translated spiritual, have been an unhelpful word to have used for the latter idea, but psukikos, the word translated natural, would have been exactly the wrong word to use for the former. The point is that Paul is using the exact same word that Plato used to describe the soul, that the unseen part that leaves the body. He's using that word to refer to our bodies right now. The soul body. The psuche body. And the question that Paul is dealing with when he's talking about spiritual body versus a natural body, the question is not whether or not it's physical. The question is, where does it get its power from? The corrupted creation or God's Spirit? And the answer, obviously, is God's Spirit. The spiritual body comes because God gives it to us through His Spirit. Look at verse 44. It says, it is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. If there is a natural body, there is also a spiritual body. And now it goes in, thus it's written, the first man, Adam, became a living being. The last Adam became a life-giving spirit. But it's not the spiritual that's first, but the natural and then the spiritual. The first man was from the earth, a man of dust. The second man is from heaven. Again, you see that contrast. Where you're from, Adam, the soulish person, was from the earth. Jesus, the spiritual person, was from heaven. It's not about whether it's physical or not. It's about where it's from, the origin of it. The spiritual body is spiritual because it comes from God, directly from Him. And it says in verse 48, as was the man of dust, so also are those who are of the dust, and as is the man of heaven, so also are those who are of heaven. Just as we have borne the image of the man of dust, we shall also bear the image of the man of heaven. In verse 49, Paul points back to Adam. We were created in God's image, but we'll find out in Genesis chapter 5 and verse 1 that his descendants are starting to be described as created or made in Adam's image. And now we are, in a sense, in Adam's image, but we are looking forward to being made into Jesus' image. He's talking about the new body that we will receive. And what Paul is saying is, what happened to Jesus 20-odd years ago, that is kind of the pattern for what's going to happen to us in the resurrection. Now we could say a whole bunch here, but I'm way over time now. I just want to end with that last section, and starting in verse 56. up to this point in verses 50 through 55, he kind of goes and explores the question, well, what happens to those who are still alive? And he says, we're going to be transformed. But here in verses 56 through 58, see what he says, how he ends this section. The sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. But thanks be to God who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. And he says in verse 58, therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain. Paul uses 57 verses to lay the foundation of what resurrection is all about, what it means, why we should believe it, and the Old Testament background for it. And then he uses one verse to say, because that's true, get to work. Paul redirects the focus from the future resurrection to the present. Be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain. And I want you to notice the very first thing that he has to say right after this section about the resurrection. He gets into the topic of the donation they need for the Jerusalem Christians who are in need. If you understand resurrection, you will understand how you are supposed to treat each other and how you are supposed to treat other Christians and how you are supposed to always keep the future in the forefront of everything you do. And when you ask questions like hard moral questions like about divorce and remarriage and homosexuality and whatever, you ask the question, yes, you can ask the question, did God say it's wrong or did he not? We can ask those questions. But another question we can ask ourselves is, what behavior is more consistent with death and resurrection? What behavior is more consistent with the concept of death and resurrection, because that's what we're living right now? I appreciate your good attention this week. I realize that this has been difficult stuff to go over because it's a lot of content, and it has been kind of difficult for me to teach. But I thought it's very important stuff because Paul talks about it all the time. And I think it's good to go over. And I heard Jason is going to preach on resurrection Sunday morning. No, I'm joking about that. But I thank you for this week. It's been great to be here. And if there's anyone who needs anything right now, needs any encouragement or anything that we can help you with, we ask that you come forward as we stand and as we sing.